So let's get started on the second panel. The title for the panel is Random Access Fundamentally Inefficient? And I'm the moderator. My name is Gustavo De Veciana. I'm with the University of Texas at Austin. And I'll have each of my panelists here introduce themselves to start with.
Okay. I'm Rajmohan Radharaman. I'm at Northeastern University of Boston.
I'm Patrick Thierrand. I am at EPFL Lausanne in Switzerland.
Kostas Zubis, I'm from USC.
And Elizabeth Valley from UC Santa Barbara.
Okay. So we're pretty much going to follow the same format as the previous panel, just maybe keep the presentations a little tighter and then have hopefully as much discussion as we had earlier. I don't have a 10 minutes of presentation myself. I do have sort of three thoughts. So first of all, it's funny that I happen to be a moderator for a panel on random access, which sort of seems that by accepting this, I've already accepted the premise that random access is not a good idea. Because I'm moderating. Which means that I'll be telling people when to speak and not to speak. Hopefully not. Second, I had sort of some interactions with Kostas about the topic of this panel. And I suggested two alternative topics. And he came back saying, well, but those two alternative topics are basically the same topic. And I think it's interesting that more or less that's what's come out. So just to tell you what the alternative topics were, the first is, does quality of service make sense in wireless networks? And I think that's something that maybe we haven't emphasized enough in this discussion on the scheduled MAC protocols, and it's obviously what you were getting at with your question at the very end. And the second proposed topic was interference a physical layer problem? And I think we're quickly discovering that interference is everybody's problem. But it's interesting maybe to abstract the question and start to think about, is it a MAC, a transport layer, a routing problem? And when do we stop? Is the application's problem? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that it should be everybody's problem. And so I think that's something that might come up. So on that note, I have maybe two last points before the panel speaks. The first one is, should we be focusing on inefficient versus sufficient in the sense that is random access fundamentally sufficient for multi-hop networks, or when is it sufficient? And the second is just analyzing the question, what exactly do we mean by inefficient? I think John sort of pointed us towards focusing on metrics. And I think the idea that throughput is sort of the primary metric is gone at this point. But going all the way to utility maximization may not really be practical. But at the very least, there's one other metric that we should be thinking about when we discuss this, which is energy. And how much energy is being expended to contend for resources and/or use those resources. So I think in answering the question, is random access fundamentally inefficient versus scheduled access, to the extent that we can, we might want to speculate about the implications in terms of energy consumption that these techniques have. So on that note, I'll let Rajmohan start. Oh, and if you don't mind, if you have a question, just raise your hand, but also tell us who you are. There's a lot of you who I'm not familiar with, and I'd like to get to know.
We can be in a much commercial.
Yeah, I have mine.
Focus on each of these things, and that's it.
So the order we're going to, number one, number two, three, four.
Okay. All right. So Gustavo raised a number of questions. I probably have mentioned maybe one of those in my presentation. So first, I want to just begin by raising a question as to how do we define random access? And that itself only while there's everybody has a notion of random access versus scheduled access, but the notion of randomness fundamentally is that each node accesses the channel independently of a certain probability. And fundamentally, random access is a symmetry breaking technique, and it's a very effective symmetry breaking technique. If you look at the use of the study of randomness within distributed computing, you can see just sort of the pervasiveness of the use of randomness as a symmetry breaking technique and how effective it is. Now, different random access protocols, quote unquote random access protocols, vary according to how this probability is chosen. Fixed with Fourier sense, varies dynamically, including collision avoidance and back off, which is what I would put, for example, the A2.11's CF. Now, for the purposes of the remainder of this presentation, I'm going to define what is not random access as being coordinated access to the channel, for example, the DMA. And using information from higher layers, for example, information about flow rates and flow control, interference information, and so on. Now, that could be debated. You could argue that a random access MAC protocol could use information from higher layers and then employ some random access. But, so here, whether random access is efficient or not, fundamentally inefficient or not, I'm going to define anything where you're using information from higher layers as not random access. So we could start off with a very simple setting where, let's say, a single hop scenario, all nodes can hear one another, and you have a uniform rate R for each of n links, and these are n links, every node can talk to each other, the total aggregate throughput is less, but the one is just a representation of the channel can use. So random access with fixed probability can achieve some throughput within a factor of optimal, and it's basically when the total rate is bounded away from one significantly, then random access would work well, but once it's saturated, random access would fundamentally be inefficient. Now this can tend to work even with you have different link rates. So if you have multiple nodes, each of them having their own different queue sizes. But if you allow their random accesses with probabilities that depend upon the queue sizes and depend upon the rates, then again you can achieve certain level of efficiency. And again, as the aggregate that rates come close to one, that's close to the saturation point, scheduled schemes would totally outperform. So what happens when we have dynamics? Okay, so one question is, if you have when you have dynamic link rates, link rates are changing, then in an random access scenario, for example, using back-off mechanisms, you are trying to determine access probabilities based on channel contentions. Exponential back-off is just a way of determining access probabilities, right? And again, there's a lot of work on study of back-off protocols. This goes back to the early 80s to late 80s. When back-off mechanisms from the perspective of studying Ethernet was considered. So there's, in theory, it has been shown and can see that exponential back-off schemes converge much more slowly and in fact are unstable. But in practice, for unsaturated conditions, they work pretty well. There's some other theoretical results that are sort of interesting, arguing that certain other kind of back-off schemes are much more effective. One thing that has not been studied much is if you have very little information about dynamics, and you want to find out. So let's suppose you have a channel, consider a single hop scenario, a single channel, different nodes with different rates, different queue lengths, and the queue lengths might change over time. But if you just implement something like CSMACA, the exponential backoff, is it competitive in an adversarial sense? If the rates change, can you still maintain a high enough throughput? I think there is some work in this, but I'm not familiar with it in terms of the theoretical study of competitiveness against adversarial input. That's unclear. Now, there has been some discussion about single hop versus multi hop. My view here actually is if you want to study random access as a MAC protocol, then multiple hop networks, the study of the how do you translate the effect of multiple hop networks can be broken down into higher layer sort of other optimization followed by a single hop or local random access. And a multi-hop network RAM access in its basic form is susceptible to interference problems. Information from channel is different for different nodes. They are sharing the same channel. And it's, of course, fundamentally inefficient if you do not use any other information from the world. It's also oblivious to end-to-end flow control. Access probabilities based on channel contention may be inefficient and inconsistent with flow control. But the above problem is not with the random portion of random access. It's inherently due to the lack of information. So if you do something like informed random access, where interference information, flow control information, routing optimization information is done in some distributed manner. It's a very complex problem. But I feel it's orthogonal to whether random access is being used as a MAC layer protocol. So if each node is made aware of rates at which adjacent links would be used, again, this would be based on study of interference at a higher layer, interference across at different layers, as well as taking into account routing, as well as flow control and rate control. Then you can build a random access scheme based on these rates. And in my view, it in some sense reduces the multi-hop case to the single hop case. Not completely, but to some extent. And in some cases, if aggregate channel rates are low, you can argue that random access is efficient, and could possibly argue that it's competitive and the link rates vary very high. So in closing, what I would like to say is that whether random access is efficient or not really depends firstly on what you define as random access, and secondly, it depends upon the information available to the MAC layer and whether random access is allowed to use this information. Whether joint rate control or routing optimization is being done at the higher layers. Whether saturated conditions are saturated versus unsaturated, and the kind of traffic boosting versus constant rate. Scenarios where random access could be competitive with unsaturated load in all parts of the multi-hop network to be well below saturation, and possibly a highly dynamic environment where joint optimization is in practice. And random access would be clearly inefficient if conditions are highly saturated. Access does not take into account inference routing flow information. Also, possibly static non-uniform traffic patterns are clearly much better handled by scheduling. And in scenarios where we need delay guarantees, as opposed to say average delay, or even I think even average delay considerations, random access could be much worse than compared to more scheduled access. What I did not discuss, and several of the points possibly were mentioned by Gustav here, so I didn't bring up any issues about energy efficiency, partly because it's also closely connected with power control, and that is also an orthogonal issue. Random access does not say anything about power control. One other area which would be very good to talk about is security and resilience to mass attacks, whether random access has some benefit in that with scheduled access, which could potentially be targeted more easily than random access. I didn't touch much on presence issues as well as specific QoS issues. So a lot more that I didn't talk about than I did. Hopefully the rest of the panel will take it.
Some comments? Questions? Don't forget to say who you are.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Umpling Bachra, USC. What does symmetry breaking mean?
Okay. So symmetry breaking refers to... So this basically, the term, at least used in several scenarios, I'm sure, but the term that I was using is in the context of in a parallel and distributed computing environment. So several nodes want access to a resource, and they see everybody seeing the same thing. So any deterministic strategy that they might use, if you just try to use a deterministic strategy without them coordinating, then everybody will be just using the same thing. So you want to break the symmetry, and one very natural, simple way to break symmetry is random access.
We got a lot of CLA. I have a question actually related to my first question. In the last slide, in the previous slide, you mentioned on one hand, in a positive manner, then you say when random access is ineffective, when I need high delay guarantees.
Yes.
And when you transmit, multiprocessors transmit dynamic traffic like again media under delay constraints, you have these competitive requirements. On one hand, you like random access according to your slide, etc.
Yeah.
So which of the two arguments would win? Would would you recommend in such a dynamic environment that we have, where we need some delay guarantees? But at the same time, so one hand you like the random access, and the other hand you don't.
One issue about these, one question about the delay guarantees is whether we are asked, whether we are considering some system-wide delay performance, or we are looking at delay guarantees on a per
user, or a per
packet. So then my feeling is you have to combine random access with some kind of priority, quote-unquote priority scheduling, where you would sort of skew the random access. You would still implement a simple scheme like random access, where you do not coordinate that much with all your neighbors in figuring out how you access channels, because it's too complicated and things are changing in time. But you give high probabilities to packets that have that require better delay.
So you're advocating what the level kind of already dies, making different priority queues at the map, and still doing some form of collision-based protocol, but then filling the queues with different types.
As long as you have unsaturated conditions.
But of course, you need the algorithms of it.
Right. So I think once, my sense is that once you have saturated conditions, random access is inefficient. So the question is, what if you have highly saturated conditions and a highly dynamic environment where joint up conditions?
Can we answer this?
Yeah.
So
sure.
I don't think it makes sense to try to have media traffic over highly dynamic environment in multiple wireless networks. So don't even try.
I don't agree for your thought.
Wait, you can try, but it's not going to happen.
I have it, and I use it.
This is single top. It's single top. It makes a huge difference. And it's even TDMA. It's not even that much. So the thing is,
we tried it, and we did it actually for our test bed for
I mean,
what the Antica is a traffic study for Intel, and we demonstrated it actually 2 years ago that you can do it.
Well, I don't know.
I think it's offline. So certainly, I mean, an 802.11e solution isn't going to work, because if everything is high priority, then you're just back to the default. I'm a big proponent of the dynamic TDMA style solution, where you get the benefit of random access, but in certain situations, and you can decide when you want to do the dynamic TDMA part, you can regulate. And so, for instance, for voice traffic, which is periodic, predictable, you can regulate, and then you can fit in everything else randomly around that. I think that's a really good solution.
So I have a problem with metrics in those systems. Like, we tend to think of wireless networks as being a wireless network where we replace the wireless by the wireless. So, and that makes a lot of sense when you have Ethernet and you have Wi-Fi. It's a wireless Ethernet. But I think that model breaks down when you think about other networks. In the ad hoc network, the point of doing ad hoc, in my mind, is not to do what we do on the wired network, but is to have new applications that are possible because of the meeting, the random meeting of people, right? And I think that the applications that could be running on those networks should not be motivated by the metrics that we have for web browsing or for Skype. It's probably quite different. It's maybe a guaranteed delivery within a given amount of time, or maybe trying to reach as many people as we can, or maybe doing an e-cast. So maybe the metrics would be quite different from what we are thinking of when we think of a WAN network or a run-on network. So a WAN network is a WAN replacement, but the hard-up network, I think, is completely different, except maybe for the mesh network of Ed, right? But I think that mobile hard-up networks are not meant to be wireless WAN network, right?
Well, certainly from the audience perspective, what they want is video, voice, push-to-talk voice. Data sort of comes later, by the way.
But I can do this, right, if you allow me to allocate separate parts of the bandwidth for video files. If you don't do that, good luck, okay? And if you, because, you know, we did extensive experiments taking all the standard routing protocols and MAC layers,
right,
under varying conditions in the physical layer and the different traffic mixtures. And we had a hard time to find one condition point the one of the protocols will be superior to the others. Clearly superior. It shows you that different parts of the protocols behave differently according to different traffic mixtures. Some of them handle bursting traffic better than others, some handle, you know, failure to the physical layer better, and so on and so forth. So Zion is absolutely right. I mean, we try to have one model in our heads, which was the old wired internet, and we're trying to get the same kind of stuff for hybrid networks, for mobile networks, for ad hoc networks, and so on and so forth, without due consideration that we can't, and that they are really designed for different reasons. Or at least the idea is to use the different reasons. I mean, I want to go around, take my camera, plus to a restaurant and get the menu, but okay, that's not the same as trying to talk to my friend when I'm in an emergency, right? This should not be.
Sure, I mean, I think your point that the effectiveness is going to be application specific.
Yeah.
But, you know, so there's a broad range of applications. Angel?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, from Kansas State University, following the protocol. In some sense, we're just talking about two extremes, right? One is completely random access, the other is scheduled access. But, you know, there's each one has really the kind of blind spot, right? In the TDMA case, and you have these issues with the synchronizations and or interference measurements and, you know, figuring out neighbor sets and things like that. And then the random access case is when you have a lot of contentions that you almost go down. And I think we should actually really think about some hybrid of these two schemes where, you know, that's I think this where the I think things can be mostly effective. It actually can be adaptive to any type of application requirements. The application could be completely real time, then it's a TDMA, you know, the protocol could act like TDMA. When the application changes into more of dynamic settings, it actually could work like a CSMA situation. So, you know, one way to do it is that we can actually sort of have a schedule when there's some certain, you know, and then also the slot owners or whatever who actually have assigned to a certain slot can always use that slot if it is that his own account. And then if the slot owner does not have any packet to transmit, then it can. The other guys actually can use carrier sensing mode to steal the slot, that's unused slot. So with this approach, what you can get is that if everybody's competing, then it works just like the TDMA, because everybody's using their own slots. And if there is some slots remaining, those slots will be not used by the owners, then the CSMA kick in, and the other guys actually using the system mode complete turns into CSMA. So if system always go in between these two, and then MAC layer kind of adapt to any type of sort of system application requirement, and that is much more, I think it's in some sense more productive than just talking about why this is good, why random access is good, and why the scheduled access is good. And we think about more sort of how we can actually merge this. The strengths of these two schemes into more working system, I think.
Last question for this.
I think what you're mentioning is basically reservation-based channel access. I mean, there have been quite a few papers in the past, and what you're saying is exactly right. When the reservations are established, then the system becomes schedule-like. When there are no reservations, the system becomes contention based, except that contentions happen in transport or contention fields.
Right, so the one issue with that, what the existing solution was, this actually requires knowledge of it. I mean, there's some kind of exact synchronization issues. Everyone has to have exact time synchronization. And coming up with schemes to actually kind of ameliorate this type of requirement could be a very effective solution.
Well, synchronization is dissolvable.
Okay, one last. I think John was first.
I mean, I like very much your point that in my mind, everything depends on the information you have about the system, because if you abstract it in a very small situation, you can prove mathematically that if you don't know about the system in trans control, what you do, you start random searches to try to find out what's going on and try to act accordingly. If you know, you go to scheduling and then uncontrolled.
So the crux of the matter is that trying to quantify this information, trying to understand how valuable it is in terms of control algorithm, and it comes back to metrics, right? So to me, this is a very fundamental question. Because we have examples where the similar problem appears in routing, that if you don't have a lot of information, you start randomly trying to find what's going on, and then you go on. If you know, then you do deterministic algorithms. Same problem in collaborative robotics, okay, for control against and so forth. It's a very fundamental problem, but it's not easy, right? And it comes back down to what are your metrics, and how do you quantify the information, and how much information you have, and how valuable it is in terms of your control. This is a very fundamental question. You're right. You put your finger right where I consider one of the key questions.
Okay. I'm going to let Elizabeth take the next.
Random access fundamentally inefficient? Yes. So you shouldn't really have a panel on it. But I'll say more. So it doesn't prevent collisions. So that could be the answer for why it's fundamentally inefficient. On the other hand, you could say no. As we were just hearing, you know, it depends on what your traffic profile looks and so forth. If there's just one transmitter in a much larger network, then you know it's super, and that's the way to go. And so really, it depends. It depends what your network looks like, how many transmitters are there, is the traffic bursty or not, is there mobility. If you have mobility, you know, forget about TDMA. So it really depends. So the position I'll take is that it's not whether or not it's fundamentally inefficient, it's that the way we're trying to do random access isn't working very well. And specifically, you know, I'll talk about UO 2.11 because that's what's commonly used for random access. So why would random access be considered inefficient? You know, as we've heard from lots of speakers, it's because of collisions. So as you add more traffic load to the network, there's going to be more and more collisions, and you're eventually going to be getting less and less out of your network once you hit the congestion point of the network. So this is a graph. We've collected a lot of data from IETF meetings because they're very chaotic and heavily used environments. So this is a graph which looks at what you get out of the network as you try to put more into it. And certainly once you pass that congestion point, then you know chaos ensues and performance increases. And so the question then is what's going on once you pass the congestion point? So certainly there's a lot of collisions, and you can look at the statistics and see, you know, that packets are getting retransmitted more and more, so you're getting less out of the network. But there's more actually than that's going on, and if 802.11 itself were responding better and were able to handle the increased usage better, you wouldn't see nearly as big a drop-off. So one of the big reasons for this drop-off is the way 802.11 responds to losses when they occur. This has to do with the rate adaptation technique called auto-rate fallback, so I'll talk about that really briefly. And then I think another problem with a lot of research going on in wireless right now doesn't as much reflect in the previous graph is this binary assumption of interference, where either all packets interfere or they don't, and in reality it's nothing like that at all. So I'll talk a little bit about each of these two and the impact. So auto rate fallback, it's not actually part of the 802.11 specification, but a lot of implementations use it. So what this is it's how 802.11 picks its data rate. And so the idea here is that if the packet loss occurs, the link must be very poor, so reduce the data rate and you'll get more robust transmissions. And X and Y here are left up to the implementers, but usually about 2 consecutive losses will result in a decrease in your data rate, whereas 2 consecutive losses or 10 consecutive receptions will result in an increase in data rate. So you sort of dynamically adjust based on what you perceive the channel quality to be. Well, if you look at what happens when there's a lot of usage, you know, as medium utilization increases, there's directly an increase in packet loss. And so what will happen then is that you'll get more packet loss, and so then you decrease your data rate. Well, in a congested network, that's exactly the wrong thing to do, right? Because then it takes longer to send the same amount of data, and you actually end up increasing the likelihood that you'll have collisions because your packets are in the air a lot longer. And so this is looking at, in this particular IETF case, the percentage of packets that were sent at each of the different 11G data rates. And so by far the largest percentage were sent at the lowest possible data rate for 11G. So if you look at the numbers, it seems like what was happening is, well, you started at 54 megabits per second, got some losses, and eventually just continued to decrease until you got stuck at the lowest possible data rate. So this wouldn't be the case if it wasn't congested. If you just had losses due to poor signal quality, everything would be great. But if we're talking about, you know, scenarios when random access may or may not work well, then addressing this problem could help it work better in a congested environment, because at least you wouldn't be making the problem worse. So what do you do? So you can differentiate the cause of packet loss, so which basically means, you know, make 802.11 a little smarter. So instead of just decreasing the packet or the data rate when any loss occurs, only decrease it when it's due to poor link quality. If the loss is due to congestion, then maintain the data rate, because decreasing it won't do anything. So this is a solution. So 802.11's solution is ARC. So the solution is WIFT. So, you know, basically just try to differentiate the cause of the packet loss. And so you can try to correlate how heavily utilized is the channel. And from that, you can try to make guesses about what the packet loss rate is or what the cause of the loss is, and then do the right thing. So this is just looking at what happens if you do try to differentiate. And so in both of these graphs, as you move towards the right, the network is being utilized more heavily. And if you decrease, so sample rate is a solution that decreases the data rate if there's loss. So as the network is more heavily utilized, performance decreases. Okay, so that's the first one. And this is just looking at the number of packets sent at each data rate. The other one, which I've seen this assumption in a lot of papers, both theoretical and experimental, is that interference is binary. So say you were trying to do call admission for a new flow and trying to decide if you could support this new flow, then the really pessimistic assumption that you make is that all of the packets are going to interfere with every node in this carrier sensing range, and, you know, so you have to have that much capacity to admit this new flow. But in reality, this isn't true either. And so what this is looking at is, there was a stationary receiver and a sender that moved around to lots of different places and sent the same amount of data no matter where it was. And even though it's sending the same amount of data, it produces completely different utilization levels at that receiver based on how many of those packets the receiver is able to perceive are being sent. So the x-axis here is just looking at medium utilization, and then the y-axis is how many of those packets were actually able to be received, which would always be less than the utilization. And so what this tells you is that even though the sender is always sending the same amount of data, you know, based on where they are and how the signal's propagating, it's clearly not an all or nothing. Well, it's somewhere in the middle. And so this is looking at specifically different locations, and so whether it's a high quality link, a low quality link, somewhere in the middle, the amount of packets that you receive, the amount your channel is actually being utilized, is going to vary, you know, because wireless signal propagation tends to vary. So you can make the pessimistic assumption that something will always interfere, or you can be more optimistic and say, well, it will never interfere because it's more than 2x away from the receiver, but in reality, it's highly fluctuate. Okay, so what can we do to improve random access? If you just look through the literature, there's lots of great ideas that people have published. They just really need to start being incorporated into solutions. So making collisions work for you, so the whole area of network coding where you can still get data even if the collisions do occur. There's been work that's looked at interference prediction, so if you can guess ahead of time which sets of links are going to interfere, then you can try to schedule those links. So if you know two links are not interfering, you can try to schedule them such that they go at the same time. Or maybe they do interfere, but the interference is small enough compared to the quality of the main signal that, you know, it's okay. So there's been a lot of work in that area as well. Don't decrease the data rate of the collisions that I was just talking about. So there's been some interesting papers that have come out recently about trying to figure out what the cause of the packet loss is. And so that would play into the rate adaptation scheme. Again, dynamic TDMA solutions, I think these are great. And you know, it's basically what Imran was talking about before to some extent. So that if you have these applications that require some sort of delay guarantee, try to latch on to a periodic slot. Otherwise, if it's just best effort, you know, use random access. Add intelligence to higher layers. So this goes back to the question about at what layer does interference really occur? So certainly you could do like intelligent routing schemes and then toggling between the others.
I just want to throw another
your name?
Way to, I'm Ruthur Mahajan from Microsoft Research. I just want to throw out another way of how random access can be improved. And it may tie into your point about adding intelligence to hardware, is just simple rate control. That taking stock of the network, just see what how much interference looks like. If you know how much nodes are sending, you can actually characterize the inefficiency. And as nodes send more, the inefficiency goes greater. So by just controlling them to a particular amount that these nodes can independently, just using random access can send, you can actually come pretty close to what best scheduling, centralized scheduling may be able to give you.
So why would the inefficiency increase as nodes send more?
As they send more, there more collisions happen. More
so
packets are lost. Yeah.
More.
So if you can just, you know, if you draw the curve, there's a point where, you know,
exactly.
If they don't send more than that, if you can just input that
yeah.
in your network, do pretty well, these.
Right, so that's basically keeping your network from hitting that congestion.
Right. So it doesn't, it never falls off.
Yeah, so that's similar to the first draft.
So you're just saying that the backup strategies are not being trained properly, because that's what you're supposed to achieve, right? Because the backup is essentially playing the kind of, reduce the number of nodes that are simultaneously accessing.
That probably is right, but the backup strategies we designed them on a packet basis, while rate control has a longer hysteresis and keeps memory as to like how much I've tried to send and how much I want to send. So there's that time scale, I think, that ends up mattering.
So I think the point, maybe, that I will talk about this a little in a while too, but the point is, in the graph that you showed, what is the utilization that you have on the x-axis? That is, have you computed what is the maximum rates that are sustainable on this network without being unstable or not? Because what is usually happening is that there is an assumption that because this is the rate that I could be sending, but you cannot really be sending in this rate precisely because of collision. So I think that what you are saying is basically you are exceeding the capacity of the network, and that's why but you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. You should use some kind of a rate control to not exceed the capacity of the network.
Right, and so the...
So I don't think this is the problem of the random access per se, it's the problem that you're not regulating.
Well, it's not a problem that's inherent in random access, but it's a problem in the way we're using random access.
Exactly.
So we could do random access more intelligently.
Right.
I think that, I mean, that's something to think about. The traditional response, Aloha, we know has a good equilibrium point that is unstable and get out of it. So maybe another way of saying is that we want to stabilize that equilibrium point. Which is, you know, basically make sure people don't get any positive feedback, all of us get congested, hence we're going to contend more, hence we're going to provide more. So
I have a quick question on your graph, the auto rate graph, where you were showing the statistics, where you just send at 54 megabits per second or you send at 11 megabits per second. I didn't quite understand what's happening to all those rates in between. Why aren't they being used?
This is the chart. What was happening in this particular scenario, because it was congested, there were lots of losses. And so either 2.11's response to loss is to decrease the data rate because it thinks the loss is due to forcing
Greek officium, add a bit so you can solve this condition application back and then use that to.
You could, it just wasn't being used in this
network. The wire network has done this for many years and it really improved performance quite a bit. So I think what I'm hearing from the community is people coming back to ideas that they were common in ATM, where you could actually use the OAM cells to find out what's happening in any of its way, whether it's physical layer, condition, or congestion between any two nodes.
Right.
And that advocates, again, the same thing I read before. Should we move an independent control panel where we decide from the beginning to set aside some bandwidth for control signaling, estimation, or whatever, and use the rest from the traffic? This becomes increasingly, in my mind, more feasible as we get into WiMAX and LTE, where you have more bandwidth available. Right now, we're trying to do everything within the same mixture of packets, and we run into all these problems. Right? I don't know what your opinion on that is.
In WiMAX, there's definitely part of the frame that's devoted to feedback.
For instance, I mean, you mentioned network coding. Okay, network coding, the only case where I can tell you theoretically it's going to work very well is when you actually have broadcast to all the users, so information dissemination. So there it works very efficiently. Even in multicast, when you start having dynamic changes in the group of people that are in the multicast or in the topology, again, the overhead comes in, and if you do the analysis with finite resources, not asymptotically, you'll find there are limits.
Mm-hmm. You have to do random network coding, and it's not going to give you much, if it's very dynamic.
Well, I have made a very strong statement network coding, which is in writing. You can call Chris Hamming, and he will give it to you. Okay, so we have to look at that. Let's not get into that. So what do you...
I think next one was Peter.
Sorry.
Well, it's actually following on the same theme. So, well, first of all, we've seen similar issues that you've just described. We're looking at similar topics, and so a lot of the results match. If you can provide feedback without needing a control channel, because if you have a control channel, you have to start worrying about access to the control channel. There's a whole bunch of issues. So you can provide feedback in a number of different ways that without having a control channel, you can include the acts if you want, you can have periodic beacons, and all these things may be much more fit to an unlicensed spectrum than having a dedicated control channel, because would you then require every protocol that uses that part of the frequency spectrum to subscribe to that particular control channel and to share it? I think there's a little bit of a challenge there in implementing a control channel in some environments.
Well, if I can answer, if you go back to SS7, right, and the standardization that followed when you wanted to do intelligent networks, these issues were resolved in a very simple way. But let me quantify something. When I mean control channel, it's an abstraction. I don't mean necessarily that you want to do it in one way. You can do feedback as a collective contract in all the layers, even in applications. So collectively, abstractly, you have a standard, but then how you implement it may differ. But you're absolutely right. Because when we move to, and I think there's another panel on that, multiple networks accessible by the same nodes, you have to resolve these issues, because at some time I'm going to use Bluetooth, and some time I'm going to use Wi-Fi, and some WiMAX, so,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that I think a control channel could be useful for is that some of the information could in fact be used by multiple mechanisms of different nodes, right?
Sure.
And so having a notion of a shared, with the concept of a control channel could actually be very useful, although our experience is that the way different mechanisms use the information may be radically different, and so, or they may operate on different timescales or something like that. So the sharing may actually be quite hard. I guess working at it.
Okay, let's let Patrick.
Okay. So, in the interest, of the panel, I will take maybe a slightly opposite point of view.
Yes. Even.
So I will try to answer that it is not fundamentally efficient. It's fundamentally. So I will try to look for the fundamentals.
So I didn't hear what you said.
not fundamentally inefficient.
Okay.
So,
so you say the focus on the
fourth
word.
Not fundamental. It is certainly not, you know, the most efficient things, but try to look for the fundamental aspects. So first one, I would distinguish a little bit what I call top-down approaches, but essentially what most people have been talking before and completing by Jean is, first, random access can be efficient in terms at least of throughput and able to reach some level of control fairness as we have seen before. So that's one argument. Of course, the drawback of some protocols is some that if we have very dynamic situations, then it becomes challenging in terms of, you know, distributing all these messages and so on. And the cost of the overhead might be extremely important. But what I would focus on is more CSMAC kind of algorithm, so bottom-up approach. And here I'm going to make a very, very strong assumption. So I will, the first assumption is that I have continuous backup distributions. And essentially, this means that I will not have collision at all. And so it removes, of course, one of the main causes of inefficiency in such networks. And I will work with saturated conditions to be a little bit more controversial. But I will just look at spatial rings. Of course, if I have saturated conditions, I mean, all the queue lengths are infinite and so on, so I'm beyond rate, I will just see how a mechanism like a CCMC algorithm uses efficiently or not the channel, so the median channel. And then I will look also at another important metric, which is fairness, which is very simple in this setting because it's the fairness is just defined on per link, so every link should have the same chances or the same proportion of time to have access to this channel. And that's what we are going to look at. So in this setting, actually, the model is very simple. So that's why we can work on it. I mean, it gives insight already even in a few slides. So essentially, it's a loss network as the one proposed by Kelly. So it has a very nice structure, I mean, in which the lower states are states at which all links are idles, and the upper states are the states, so each layer has more and more active links concurrently, and the top states would be typically a maximal independent set in this setting. And the stationary probability that k links are active has a nice product form, so it's possible to compute it, although the normalization constant might be quite complex to compute for a very large network, but at least it gives some insight. And one of the first insights is that we see that if lambda is 1 over lambda is the mean backoff duration, so if the backoff becomes extremely small, so I'm very aggressive, well, essentially the probability that I have an independent set tends to 1. So my claim that a CSMACA protocol is spatially efficient is backed by the fact that they spontaneously, without any coordination, find the maximal independent set, and that is true for any graph. So that's really a very nice property. You couldn't do better with something centralized. Just to see what it gives on a graph, for example, where one link out of 3 could be active in a maximal independent set, well, the best you could have is this blue line, and you will tend to it if you are very aggressive with the back. Of course, that comes at a high cost, and that's the fact that if I increase the lack of value, and here I have actually put the proportions on the horizontal axis, I have something like 50 nodes, and so it's the percentage of time that each node accesses the channel, then I will have something which is quite fair, except for some border effect at the edges. If I am not too aggressive and I have a small spatial use, if I push the backoff to be much more aggressive, I get a better spatial use, but you see that I get something which is quite unfair. And so one thing which is fundamental, I think, in this case, and is that fairness, I mean, there is really a fundamental trade-off between spatial reuse and fairness, which is intrinsic to this protocol. And to make the point, to show that it depends really on things which are beyond the node degree and so on, I will take a very regular structure, like a lattice, and I take just exactly the same, but one is small, one is large. I do the same in two dimensions. I take one which is small and much is large. Of course, the load degree and so on, everything is the same on that scenario. And I just look at two metrics. The first one will be the spatial reuse, and the other one is a fairness index that measures how much I deviate from the uniform distribution in the access link intensity to different links as a function of the aggressivity of the buffer. And I see that, I mean, the first picture, whether I take L large or small, I have roughly the same thing in the one-dimensional lattice. Essentially, as I am aggressive with the backoff, I reuse the medium quite efficiently, but I lose in fairness. However, this effect, if I take a large network, they remain confined to the edge of the network and they don't propagate in the center of the network. But if I take the two-dimensional lattice, I observe something qualitatively different. Indeed, for a small network, I keep qualitatively the same behavior, but you see that I have a big bump if I have a two-dimensional network, and the spatial reuse improves significantly, but it decreases very suddenly in terms of fairness, where I have something which is quite fair, and then suddenly I have a collapse in the fairness, so something which has been observed already, I mean, Ed will certainly mention, speak of salvation in histo. And so here, even though we don't have collisions, we have actually some form of starvation which is explained. I mean, these sudden changes are explained by a phase transition mechanism occurring in the network. And so to see a little bit what happens, let's take two different values of this lambda. One value is small, and in this, for this value, here I have the fraction, I mean, of the distribution of the access intensity of all the links in the network. And if I have backoffs which are pretty conservative, then I keep something which is, roughly speaking, Gaussian, but it's very unimodal. So all the links get access 1/8 of the time, more or less, because there are 8 maximal independent sets in this scenario, access to the medium. I have something which is relatively fair. If I push the backoff to be much more aggressive, then I have a situation where essentially some lucky guys, roughly 1/8 of them, have all the time access to the channel, and all the others just never have any access to the channel. So I have something which corresponds for me to starvation. Actually, there's a phase transition that we can prove, which is associated to the fact that in the model I have one or multiple Gibbs measure. And so I have starvation, but I have a cause of starvation which is just the size of the topology. It's not even the shape of the topology, it's just the size of the topology, without collision or without interaction at the flow level, since I don't have any traffic matrix here, which is really a prejudice for this set. But on the other hand, the remedy might be incremental. I might actually, and I can compute that also for any graph, compute a lower bound on this backoff value, so I know how to be not too aggressive, in order to keep ourselves with, and before the phase transition just occurs. Another comment I would like to make about spatial efficiency is what happens if I take some of the more, I mean, the more physical layer constraints into account. Yes, sure.
It just in what you're doing, you're using this high rate exponential, and but how are you actually doing it? Are you waiting for this Kelly network to kind of reach an equilibrium?
Yeah, so I work only with the steady state.
So how do you get the steady state?
Oh, if you take a finite network, the finite network is ergodic, so we'll always reach a steady state. For the phase transition itself,
yeah,
you can as a hardcore model.
If you're pushing lambda to infinity.
No, here we work with lambda, which is finite. Right?
Okay, but if you're pushing it very large at the time required to reach steady state,
of course.
You're going to stay
of
in
course.
A high state for a long time, then you're going to die.
Of course. Oh, no, the steady state is actually, you reach the steady state very very quickly. You reach the steady state, but you remain locked in the steady state for a very long time.
It depends on the state space. I mean, if you have a geometric state space, then you're going to take a long time to get
well, here the state space is just the independent sets of so the different transmission
I was suggesting
patterns.
So if you're simulating this and you're kind of waiting to reach steady state, but you're saying that in the high lambda case you're going to get one guy who's hogging everything, that could just be because that guy's the first who wins the race,
exactly.
And he's got a high lambda, and he just stays there for a long
time. So I cannot predict which one
so
will win.
So you haven't reached steady state, you just made one transition.
Oh, it's not only one transition. I mean, it takes some time to settle, but it goes. But you are trapped in, if you want, in one of, is the symmetry break. It's a kind of symmetry breaking. Essentially, you are trapped in a local minimum of, you can associate to this system an energy function, and the thing that you have is that you have multiple, local equilibria, and then you get in one of this equilibrium, and then you are locked in this equilibrium for a long time. I mean, forever in two dimensions.
All these all these equilibria points look the same. They're all
well, for the grid, yeah, there is a lot of symmetry. For a run, for a graph, which is then you would have something which is very difficult to analyze. I mean, it's finding the independent sets. It is itself an EPR problem. So. Yes.
I want to relate that a little bit to what Jean is doing. So in your case, you assume that all the Qs are full all the time.
Exactly.
Lambdas are fixed. Right? So if you assume a dynamic model where the lambda depends on the backdrop. So if some nodes starve, then of course the lambda will change, right? And they will not keep on pushing. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
If another one is a usual backdrop, to be more aggressive. So the problem is quite different.
Yeah, essentially what the adaptive algorithm should do is to come back in the same, in the safe area where there's only one phase.
Not really. The lambdas will adjust automatically to be able to serve the rates, to serve backlogs.
So you're alluding to some rate control, essentially.
So he's proposing a solution to your problem.
Yes.
The solution of German, right, is like that. The lambda depends on the backlog. As the backlog increases, you become more aggressive, so you do not stack.
Yes, yes.
But of course, it's ideal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, probably it will self heal. But not sure. I mean, this probably could be. Another little point I would like to make is what happens. I mean, so another easy fix or is the fact that so far, I mean, this model I assume carries sense range to be the same as receiver range. Actually, if we do not assume the two to be equal, the Markov chain essentially changes a little bit. It changes in the set, so I still have exactly the same kind of things, but here I have more nodes. I mean, the carry sense range from the emitter is larger than the receiver range, so I have an asymmetric exclusion domain. More nodes are silenced from the emitter side than from the receiver side. And in this case, in this model, what I lose is the reversibility. Because I cannot go back, I mean, the order in which transmission because of the capture effect arrive or leave does matter, so I cannot analyze it as well as the other one. Actually, it's much more complex. The nice thing is that the reason why you keep locked in one of these maximum independent sets is that essentially, as lambda is very aggressive, it pushes you to go to visit states at the top of the Markov chain, and so you just oscillate between the top level and the level just before this top level. And you oscillate between these two without mixing things in.
So then you can never really achieve a steady state distribution because you're gonna take a finite number of transitions, you're gonna take 10 transitions, then you're gonna oscillate.
No, in 1D you will always, there's always a strictly positive probability that eventually you will
move back.
Exactly.
But in any finite...
In exponentially large...
Any polynomial time,
yes.
You're going to get trapped in...
Exactly. No, so what happens in the second case is that for the same value, I would oscillate also between the top level and the level bottom, but in some cases, I don't have any transition back to the top level. So I just will go down further down in my Markov chain, so I will liberate many more links, and so this will allow me to much faster go back following another path to some other maximum independent set, and so I will visit and browse many more of these different independent sets. So what I will have is that I will have something which is much fairer. Actually, maybe we see that better on this diagram. So if I take the same scenario with a symmetric or with a capture effect, see that we have something which is much fairer for the same value of this parameter lambda, just because I browse things better in the second Markov chain than in the first Markov chain. And just the fact of having an asymmetry, an irregularity, obliges me to move quickly from one state of maximum spatial reuse to another one. I need to go down further in Markov.
So you are saying that capture helps, which we
capture
know,
helps.
We know it should help, right?
It should help, but for fairness, it helps. It decreases the spatial reuse, though, because I still have a Kerrison's range which is larger than the receiver range, so I inhibit many more nodes, but it does help for fairness.
Can I ask the following? Instead of looking for a steady state of the time, looking, is it possible to look at, how should I describe it, of the analog of a limit cycle, so that I can address the question.
But that would be another remedy, right? It's because if you have a limit cycle that could visit each of the maximal independent sets,
you would do that with dynamic lambda.
Probably, I mean.
Because that would get away from all the questions from the fairness. Mathematically, I believe it's possible, but whether it will get a real implementation, I don't know.
I don't know. So finally, maybe just to put the comparison between this model and what you would have in at least an NS2 simulation, and okay, it's a real one, there is some discrepancy, especially if the contention window is extremely small, because then collisions actually, even just between RTS and ETS, take over. But if you take a control channel, so if you put RTS, CTS on control channel, so they are different. I mean, I don't want to enter in details, but they are different. So if you use a purlink backoff instead of a perl node backoff, and if you use a control channel, then you can reduce actually the difference between D2 to the only top rectangle here. So in particular, with the contention window which follows the binary exponential backoff, you are very close in terms of spatial reuse to what the model predicts. So we can trace back exactly what causes actually the collisions in such a mode. So to conclude my statement, so I think random access algorithm can be spatially efficient at least either by having an intermediate solution, which I would say between the scheduling centralized scheduling schemes and complete CSMSEA kind of algorithm by message passing, or even using CSMSE. They can be spatially efficient, but the price to pay is starvation even without collision. So we can have that. And it's something which is fundamental to this kind of networks. But solutions one has a sense that solution could be actually more incremental or simpler in many cases. I just mentioned just one, playing on lambda to adapt spatial reuse and fairness, and playing with irregularities such as a different Kerrison's range from receiver range if we have capture. So irregularity in this network, I think, often helps, at least for the problems here, the fact that whenever I have something which is fluctuating in time, I break something, scenario in which I'm locked during a long, long time. And so this is something which might be actually helpful, and that's a feature of wireless network just here. And finally, I think it's what we need actually to go down and to really discuss is also models that maybe are not, make very strong assumptions that I did know, but where we can get insight about how tuning of one parameter does affect or does not affect things. Many models tend to be very comprehensive, so you have a large Markov chain, for example, with many states, and then it's closer to high-level simulation. It's difficult to get insight other than by solving numerically the model. But that, I think, is the panel. So I will stop here.
One or two questions?
Can I ask about capture? So you say capture helps fairness, but it seems like the winner of capture is
actually
happy, somebody else has to be unhappy. So
it's not completely true. We analyzed two models of capture, and the one where you would say that systematically I capture on the strongest signal helps less than the one in which the order in which signals arrive do help. So there's
okay.
I mean, literature we found, the most frequent one is a limited capture model versus a full capture. Actually, the limited does restore fairness much better than the previous one. Here is the curve. I mean, these are the two models. The top one is really the one in which I do not lock systematically on the strongest signal. And actually, this creates more irregularity, and this helps to restore more fairness, but I pay a price in special cases.
I guess this was already touched upon in the previous comments, but it would seem like in the cases where you have good spatial reuse but poor fairness, then the task of fairness should be handed over to the higher layers. Maybe the rate control.
Poor fairness here is pearling fairness. So if I put a traffic matrix on top of that, essentially I will have something. So it means that some links get to, so if I have the flow that needs to cover two hops, the delay will be, and the throughput, for example, if I have TCP, would just vanish just because the first packet will make it through the first hop, but the second hop, I mean, they will wait a long, long time before I suddenly switch from one schedule, I mean, one independent set to the next one. And this can be, I mean, exactly non-polynomial, can be extremely...
So
extremely
are you saying that you couldn't hand it over to them?
I think it needs to be solved already at the map layer.
I'll show you
a way.
Okay.
Exactly.
Perfect transition then? Question?
Yes.
Why not just rerun the Markov chain starting at state zero? Re-randomize
the Markov chain. Oh yeah, that I mean, if I put more noise in, and so if or if I reset, yeah, that's that would be another solution. I could show some. So we have graphs where, yeah, exactly. So that's one way of doing it, of course. But of course, then it means everyone needs to be ready from time to time to basically pick a new value of the backup. Just at random and reset things, essentially.
Okay, so I'm going to be even more positive than Patrick for random access, and I'm going to speak in defense of random access. I'm going to argue that it's kind of easier. Let me start with popular wisdom. Popular wisdom really says that random access is both inefficient and unfair. And I've seen a lot of examples there arguing for it. But the best way to really address this is to do the following reality check. We will consider a random access scheme, let's say CSMA-CA in particular, let's consider 82.11, since this is the reason why we talk about random access in the first place. And we will compare the achievable rate region, you can call it capacity region, of optimal collision-free scheduling with what you get from 82.11. And there will be cases possibly that the performance of 82.11 might be bad, but then we need to understand why it is bad and whether it is really the problem of random access or it is a problem of some layers, maybe implementation, maybe wrong assumptions, maybe other higher layers, and so on. So that's basically what I'm going to do. And let me start with the first popular wisdom, inefficient. The standard topology where people show that random access is quite inefficient is this chain topology here on the left. So we have 15 guys, there are two flows going from the left to the right and from the right to the left. And on the right side, I'm showing you the achievable rate region of an optimal scheduler, this is a green line, and of 82.11 with anti-ACTS here. So by the way, the lines are verified both by experiments, we have experiments, simulations through QualNet, and theory. So you have to believe that the blue line is indeed what 82.11 can achieve. And as you can see, it's pretty good. I mean, it achieves 63% of the optimal in this topology. And I'm talking about end-to-end rates, despite the fact that, as Patrick mentioned, maybe you will have unfairness issues. I'll address this in my next slide. It's pretty good. And the overhead is really low. So why people say that random access is very inefficient? Well, the reason is the following. Because they don't look at the capacity region and what random access is offering us, but instead they look at the saturation point. So they say, okay, everybody always has things to send, what do I get? Well, this is what you get in this case, and if this is 100 nodes, this is going to go all the way to zero. So the saturation point is going to go to zero. But this is not really the way to look at it. This is the achievable rate region that you have. You better pick a better operational point than the saturation point. So not to mention that saturation points are neither realistic nor particularly insightful. They imply that you are outside the stability region of the network anyway. You should use some type of rate control. Zan suggested something. There might be other ideas too, to really be in another point of the rate region. So the second thing is people say it's unfair. Particularly unfair. So this topology on the left is the well-known flow in the middle topology, which is the canonical topology that people use to show that random access is very unfair. Again, on the right side of the slide, I'm showing you the achievable rate region of the optimal collision-free perfect scheduler and of random access of 83.11 in particular. As before, the rate region offers plenty of good options. The saturation point is particularly unfair indeed. The y-axis is the rate of the middle flow. The x-axis is the rate of the two outer flows by symmetry they are the same. The saturation point just completely starves the middle flow. But that's not the problem of random access. You should go into another point. So people say, as I said before, we should use rate control. So people said, fine, let's use TCP. That's the rate control that everybody is using for 20 years now. What TCP is doing? This is what TCP is doing. So then people started saying, random access is really bad. I'm using TCP over it, and after three hops, John said that, I'm getting zero. Well, of course you get zero, because you operate at this bad point. Let's use a different rate control scheme, but it's going to put us close to the maximum point, or anywhere you want, by the way. So now the next question becomes, can we have such a rate controller that is really simple, easy to implement, distributed, and get to this point? Or do we end up having to solve an NP-hard problem, something as complicated as a perfect scheduler, to get to these nice points under random access? So probably we don't need this slide, but I'm going to go through this anyway to kind of allude to how this rate controller should look like. This is a Malkov setting, which is the hard case. And as you saw, I'm talking about Malkov settings here. So when this link becomes congested in the wireline world, what we do is usually we say all the flows that they go through this link should do something about the rate to alleviate for congestion. This is what rate control does in wireline world. In the case of Malkov networks, the story, as we all know, is a lot more complicated because, for now, let's assume a single disk model. It doesn't matter. Everybody within the range of the source and the destination are potentially interfering with this link. So every single flow that is traversing this neighborhood is causing congestion to this link. In other words, whatever the rate control is going to do, it has to be aware that there is interference. The contention is not within a single link, as in wired networks. And it has to be neighborhood-centric. It has to do something in the whole neighborhood of congestion. So, as a proof of concept, I will describe you in three lines an extremely simple rate controller, and I'll show you how it performs. So the idea is, if a queue gets congested, one hop neighbors of the sender and the receiver of this queue will map all the flows going through their incoming and outgoing links. We don't even change the TCP client at all. The TCP client will get the map, will reduce the rate, whatever. Okay, so essentially what I'm doing here is I'm saying every single flow that's going to go through this neighborhood is going to be mapped. That's it, nothing else. And there is not even any overhead here because you are broadcasting anyway the information. So if there is a queue that is congested, just set up a bit. Everybody's going to receive it anyway, the one hop neighbors. So
how did you define congested?
I'll get back. I can answer now. I mean, you can just have a threshold on your queue. Even this is going to work. These results I'm going to show you, as I said, they are also verified by an experimental tester in addition to theory and whatnot. This is what we had before. This is the flow in the middle topology. This is where TCP is. If I do the very, very simple thing I just described to you here, here I am. This is the neighborhood-centric performance of this extremely simple rate controller. And it's not even particularly optimized. I mean, if you play a little bit more with it, you might get really close to max min. Who knows?
TCP and sources react.
TCP, client. So when you get this, you just halve your window. That's all we do.
It's like
ECM. Precisely like ECM. But the ECM bit is set in the complete neighborhood sense. That's it. So,
it's
pretty efficient, in my opinion, apparently. Now, how bad can random access be, really?
What happens if you have multiple queues at the same mark?
You only do this once. That is, so I can explain the details of the protocol precisely. Let me give you an example. So there is a flow, right? The flow is going through multiple neighborhoods. So the moment you set the bit, you set the bit. That's it. So if you have to set the bit again, it's only the same.
I mean, in the same neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
I have more than one queue that they set bits.
So every flow that is crossing a congested neighborhood is going to get a marked bit. If you So the neighborhood is link specific. So whenever a queue gets congested, it has an associated neighborhood with it. It could be another guy close to this guy that is also congested. It has another neighborhood that is congested.
I understand that, but suppose in the same neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
right?
What do you mean by the same neighborhood? There's no same neighborhood. That's the thing.
Okay, however you define neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to tell me a subset of nodes.
Okay. Yes, of links actually. It's
of links or whatever. Okay. So in the same set that we call neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
I got two guys that they do bidding.
Yes.
They do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have three, four.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if I have?
So the following happens: every single link is associated with its own neighborhood. There will be overlaps in these neighborhoods that you discussed because these links are close by. Every flow that is going through a congested neighborhood, it's gonna mark. It's gonna get an ECN bit. That's it. So. Let's say the neighborhood of the first guy is here and of the second guy is there.
Marking or probabilistic marking?
It's deterministic marking. You don't even have to do it probabilistically. I can optimize over it, but I'm telling you what I'm showing you, it's just deterministic marking. So, but of course, is it everything rolls? No. How bad can a random access really be? What is the fundamental limit of random access? And Patrick talked a little bit about this, mentioning this maximal thing. I want to make it a little bit more specific. So what is the worst case scenario of random access, of 82.11. Since we have done this analytical work of computing the achievable rate region of 82.11, and we had to go through every single possible local topology to figure out what's going on, we actually concluded it's not very hard to figure it out. So that's the worst case scenario. When you have many edges that interfere with an edge under study, but they don't interfere with each other. Because essentially, random access is based on interference to pass along information about contention. So what you have here, you have all these guys that they don't talk to each other, but they're interfering with you. That's the worst case scenario if you don't have a centralized scheduler. So and this is basically the case here on the left. So in two cases, depending on the direction of the edge, this is a detail, I don't want to get into that. For those of you that are familiar with this literature, it has to do with whether we have a coordinated station and an asymmetric topology subcase. On the right, I'm showing you again, the max min rate of each set, if you check this particular topology, the max min rate allocation is exactly the same for all the flows in this particular topology as a function of the number of neighbors. And as you can see, here things get bad. The more neighbors you get, the larger the distance from the optima. The blue line is the optima. The lines that are decreasing as n are what you get with random access. But who cares in practice? Do you ever have such topologies in practice? I mean, how many neighbors can you have that they are within range of yourself, but they are out of range of themselves? Because this is really what should happen. Even geometrically, if you analyze this, it's like a maximum of 6 or 7. But if you look at any reasonable Markov topology, you will never have more than 2 or 3 neighbors like that. So you will not really be very low in this case. And as an aside, as Patrick mentioned at some point, the very similar setup has been used to argue about the worst case scenario of maximal versus maximum weight matching by Saswati and other guys later on. And this is further motivating the intuitive correspondence that we have about random access and maximal matching. So essentially, I mean, I've heard a lot of people saying that probably this is the case. We have a proof, but I don't want to get into that now. That essentially, random access is as good as grid. It's doing maximal, as Patrick is saying. And which means that in the worst case scenario, this is what you're going to have. But as I said, it's not a big deal because in practical topology, you're not going to have a lot of sets at least.
This topology was probably the worst case, and worst case in terms of fairness, is that right?
It's probably the worst case as a local topology in terms of throughput. I'm not showing fairness here, I'm showing throughput. So every single link in this topology has the same rate in the max min point. I'm not showing the region. So it's the worst distance between the blue line, which in this case is the optimal scheduler, because the optimal scheduler is going to do the following. It's going to either schedule the left guys or the right guys, because the left guys do not interfere with each other. So even if you put 100 links on the left, the optimal scheduler will schedule the 100 guys at the same time. But random access, these 100 guys are not going to be scheduled at the same time. So the problem really is that random access is not properly scheduling the guys on the left.
And local just bounds the size of the network to a two hop or three hop?
Yeah, geometrically speaking, you will not have more than six or seven guys. But in practice, I mean, you know, it's better than me, you're not going to have more than two guys.
I guess when you said this is the worst case over all local topologies,
yes.
What's a local topology?
Okay, I mean, I'm not going to, the proof doesn't look at every arbitrary end-to-end case.
Right.
This is what I mean. But we should talk more about the proof than that. Okay, there is one more slide, but go ahead.
I'm tempted to ask what happens if the backdrop depends on the QDAC, for this example.
I haven't tried it out, but I think it's
going to
be even better. I mean,
it should stabilize.
Exactly,
it
should stabilize.
Yeah, if you allow the mark to be probabilistic and the kind of parameters, you can only do better.
Yeah, I think it's going to be better.
So, when you say that in practice such topologies rarely occur, but if you have a large enough topology, it's quite likely that there would be some nodes might have some situations like.
So what I'm suggesting is you actually do some topologies on your own, put the fixed routing because all the mesh networks use fixed routing. Assume source destination mesh, draw your flows, and see how often this thing occurs, and you will see that it doesn't occur. That is, if you look at every single link along
but
the
one
path,
question you could ask is, even if it occurs,
mm-hmm.
does the impact is the impact of that local or is the impact of that?
So let's say it occurs. What then?
If it occurs, instead of having 0.45, you will have 0.25. You will still be within 50% of what the optimal scheduler would give to this rate. That's it.
Okay, I think we come from different things. Inefficient for me is 50%.
No.
And for you, it's
good. So
let me
address this. So I'm not aware of any single. This is actually very efficient. This is a very good point because there isn't any. I'm not aware of any paper right now that is trying to do approximate perfect scheduling, whose constant over the optimal throughput is not a lot worse than 50%. So basically, all the papers they say I'm going to have an 1 over k or a 1 minus epsilon of the optimal throughput. So essentially, they already don't know.
I'm going to just be the double that. Okay, you're being too postmodern. What do I care about the neighbors?
So my point is the following. You cannot get, well, I shouldn't be saying this, but I haven't seen any distributed polynomial type algorithm that creates an approximate collision-free scheduling that achieves more than 50% of the optimal rate.
But that's in a worst case setting.
Very good point.
Okay, so
very
you have to be careful there.
So, that is very good, yeah. This is the worst case, he's right. So how close you can go, I don't know. At the moment you put the overhead of building this scheduler, even if you go order of 1 over epsilon, let's say hops, to achieve this 1 minus epsilon distance from the optimal throughput, if you just put the overhead there, you will be, even in the average case, less than 50%, because you have to exchange a lot of packets, even within two or three hops, to do a local.
No. That's a misconception, right? But we can take that offline.
Yes.
But that's a misconception.
Anyway, I will be. I agree. This is the problem. Whether you are at 50% or 6% or 65% doesn't really matter.
For fairness' sake, so what if you try to do maximum social welfare whether the utility of a flow is the alpha fairness, but alpha is very large, so they approximate max pain.
I don't know, but I think it's a very good idea to try that. So actually, the very simple, of course I'm skipping some details since you are mentioning alpha fairness, the very simple mechanism just described about this rate controller, if you use it in different topologies, it achieves a version of alpha fairness in the sense that the actual rate that the flow gets is inversely proportional to the number of congested neighborhoods that it is traversing. So, similar to the usual Kerr example of proportional fairness when you go into a wild line network and you have a number of nodes. Maybe should I proceed to the last slide?
Yes, please.
So other points that they are less important. Do not dismiss RTS-CTS. This is really for systems guys that they are saying we shouldn't be using RTS-CTS. If you don't use RTS-CTS, then you're going to be really bad. In this particular case, for example, where the senders do not hear each other. The blue line is without RTS-CTS. The red line is with RTS-CTS. Second point, improve RTS-CTS or any other mechanism like RTS-CTS to do the job right for Mantico. Other speakers mentioned that too. So in the first topology there on the left, RTS-CTS works in the sense that it avoids collisions. In the second case, it doesn't, because whatever flow is sending, flow 1 collides with it because it's unaware of what flow 2 is doing because of the way RTS-CTS is designed, and you get a further reduction in throughput. Last point, there are some silly things, implementation-related silly things, so they are killing the performance of random access, and then people don't realize that this is the problem. So, for example, auto-rate adaptation, we just bumped on that when we were doing some experiments. So what auto-adaptation, for whatever reason, it's implemented such that the physical header is always set at the lower rate. So now assume you're sending a physical header at 1 megabit per second, and you send your data at 11 megabit per second. This means that the transmission time of any control packet, RTS, CTS, ACK, whatever, is the same with the transmission time of your large data packet. Of course this is not going to work well. I mean, what type of a communication system would ever have control messages having the same transmission time with data messages? But that's an implementation silly thing. It has nothing to do with random access. So, summary, random access can be efficient as long as it is paired with the right rate controller. The worst case, well, within 50% if this is efficient for you. The worst case performance is actually good when real life limitations are taken into account with respect to how weird your topology can really be in practice. And random access is often accused for some of the FTCs. So that's what I wanted to say. And I'm going to get more fire now.
Okay, so this is pretty good. All this is predicated to the use of RAIDs, assuming that RAID is a good characteristic of traffic. What if I throw at this traffic, which is a mixture, I won't go even to video, forget video, but it is different in the case, in the way it's bursting. What happens then? Because then you don't have a RAID.
I mean, you are saying, what if your flows are really short?
Well, I mean, what we found is if we do exactly what you did, okay, or very close to it, when I mixed traffic that has different degrees of burstiness, I can make things like that go really bananas as far as even giving the right access to people, okay?
I mean, the way you are right, that it will deteriorate the performance in an absolute manner, but
now, of course,
I
you understand I'm setting you up, because when I have burstiness,
knowing
timing is extremely important, and in random access you neglect it.
So well, the thing is, though, that I think I have to check it out, that in an absolute manner, random access will do worse, but in a relative manner, with the scheduler, it's going to do a lot better, because the scheduler is going to be even more killed by the fact that you have this amazing burstiness that you are describing. So essentially, very large burstiness is going to kill any system, right? I mean, the performance of your communication system is going to go down the more large the variances in the arrivals. Right, I mean, this is a well-known result, even with baby queuing. So if you have huge variance in your arrival process, you will get very bad performance, that's it. But the question is, the relative difference between something like random access versus something that it's trying to adapt to the burstiness and to everything else to come up with a predefined schedule, what is it then? So,
but I can integrate out and reduce the burstiness in scheduling. With this, I have no hope.
You mean you do some arrays, you do some admission control at the ingress points?
Yeah, I guess, again, I'm coming from control theory, although this has been used communication. Okay, I can use integrated to the system, right, to try to get the burstiness out.
Then maybe John's idea is good. You can do the same thing and change your peak, you know, based on that. So.
I think, Jim?
Unrelated to efficiency, about the RTS-CTS, we certainly measure this with RTS-CTS or without RTS-CTS?
With. All the results I show you are with RTS-CTS, and I acknowledge that if you don't put RTS-CTS, there are cases like the one I show you that you can do really bad. Because then you have... So essentially, none of these results are pure random access, if this is what you're alluding to. You do have some local exchange of information to figure out. You are a little bit more intelligent. I don't see why you shouldn't be.
Okay, then you said that RTS-CTS, the definition of sent in low rate, because we need other neighbors to hear them also.
No, no, this is
so that's a specification.
It's not a specification, it's the way
implementation by people.
So the way that auto rate adaptation is implemented, this is what it is doing. It is sending the physical header always at the lowest possible rate, even the physical header of the data pipe.
But there is some logic. You want some labels that have low-link quality to you to be able to capture this header or RTS or CTS.
I don't think that there is logic to it. Forget about RTS and CTS. You have to send an app, right?
But
you have to send an app in the link layer.
Okay.
Plus, whenever you send the data, plus whenever you send the data packet, you still have to send the physical header.
Yes.
So now you are having a system, forget about RTS and CTS, where two-thirds of your throughput, by definition, is wasted on control. Because your transmission range of your header, then you have your payload, then you have the app back. This system doesn't make sense to me at all. You have to be
somebody implemented it this way.
Yeah, I don't know why.
They're able to hear your hack. I end up with a handshake, I'm sending an app.
I mean, if you have auto rate adaptation with a collision-free scheduler, you have exactly the same problem. You
no,
still
I'm
have
not
to get an app.
Collision-free, I just trying to avoid us changing the app rate and the CTS rate and the RTS rate. There is some logic to this. It's not the.
What are you advocating? That we just need more power rather than transmitting over the same duration? Because you have to do something. You have to protect control messages.
Yeah,
more
I
than
think
your suggestion
is a good one.
But
or maybe disable. I don't
maybe
know whether
it's
disable or rate adaptation.
Adapt.
In some other fashion. I mean, I don't know.
Time and rate are not necessarily. It depends on how you implement it. If you say that demonstrates that the radio has to operate at a constant power level, then you may not be able to do it any other way than increasing the time.
But I think you can change the power. So in the experiments we're doing, there is a smart Wi-Fi driver. I'm not really a systems person, but my students were telling me that, yeah, you go into the driver and you just change the power by which. And these are like chips, $200 boxes that we're using.
But
and you can already change the power easily.
So
I don't have a solution for this. I just wanted to bring it out as an issue of today's implementation. I don't have
a solution. Yeah, but it is, you recognize that the control packets have to be protected differently from the data packets.
Yes,
because
yes.
They are more important, otherwise the pack.
I just think that the current implementation doesn't make sense.
Every time you increase your transmit power, you're going to create more interference for other nodes, right? So you can't just. Anyway, there's an impact there that.
So I was left slightly confused by the ending of Patrick's talk and then your talk, because Patrick at the end told me there's no way I can hand over my problems from the MAC layer to the higher layer rate controllers. And you just said that's exactly what you should do.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, with respect to fairness, you both are clearly in disagreement, at least as far as I can tell.
I think the difference is
that
Patrick, just one point with me further. Patrick's results are under saturation point conditions. I think this is going to answer your question. That's
So
there is.
Exactly. So it's as I mean, once you are out of this, so the reason why we did saturation is just that then it makes things very clean mathematically from one end to the other. Right. Now, as soon as you leave that, then it's but it's much more complex, of course, because then you begin to work
no
with Q.
There's no longer fairness trade-off, the fact that you will get good spatial reuse and poor fairness. You're saying that won't happen in the unsaturated.
No, in the unsaturated case, if you take, for example, measures which are proportional to the Q, then it will balance much better the Qs and the condition. If all of them are all the time infinite, then of course you are out of this. So that's the difference between the two.
You are in agreement.
Yes, actually.
That's right. You're not in the extreme points of the
Going back to the RTS CTS process, I think the question is, if you want to implement a low complexity, good efficiency, even within the 60%, you're sort of hiding under the rug the cost of RTS CTS and the implementation issues.
It's on the rug.
Is how do you actually schedule? How do you let the people around you know what they should know? You are now accounting for that, and you have the results. And I would argue the slower overhead, the higher power, those are all solutions that still can cannot address this issue that is fundamentally how much energy or time do you need to guarantee a certain deadlock free passage of information.
So I am not. In this clause that I have shown you, the overhead of RDCDS is there.
No, but I think that the issue is how do you acquire, John's point is how do one take into account local information? You know that you have this and that table, but if the network is moving around, there has to be some mechanism that I know that who my neighbors are.
So you are referring to this neighborhood-centric thing and how to be implemented?
No. But I sent an RTS to him.
But you don't send it to him
because I know he's my neighbor.
No. Just broadcast it. This is not how it works. You don't have to know
anything. Then it's not an RTS. You need to know.
I mean, you broadcast it.
No. But I need to know that he could be my neighbor. Otherwise,
yes.
Why should I send the RTS?
So your ID is, you mean if you have no neighbors whatsoever?
No, I guess the CSMA is broadcast, but RTS you need to unicast it to a neighbor, right? And you need to know who the neighbor is.
You need to put your ID in the RTS, and so the guy that is going to get it will know who sent the RTS.
Yeah,
so that you will
type up the receiver's ID.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
yes.
How do I acquire that knowledge? Let me put it this way. If you can acquire that knowledge, you can build scheduling. That's the way many distributed schedulers work. You acquire the minimum knowledge you know is who your neighbors are. Based on that, you can do worse and or better. But
So, you could do a distributed scheduler. I don't know how much this is going to give you. That is, this distributed scheduler is going to have some performance. It's not going to be the optimal because the optimal would require a centralized thing to be performed.
If I may jump in with a question, why is this an RTS-CTS issue? I don't see. Even if you don't use RTS-CTS, you're still unicasting your data.
Yeah. In order for me to give you an RTS, I need to know who you are.
True, but
how
I'm saying
getting that knowledge.
But I'm saying this is required even if you get rid of
RTS-CTS.
Yes.
I know.
You need
so
it for running packets.
Huh?
You need it for forwarding, basically.
But
yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So I don't see.
So if you have that knowledge, you can be
accessible.
Do you accept
that you need to have that knowledge?
I agree, you do.
So
you
if you have that knowledge, you can build a schedule, a distributed scheduler. And then the comparison should be done against a distributed scheduler where you can make reservations for the communicating parties. And I would say that the 5% and the 50%.
Okay.
For me,
it's
a good point.
I'm going to ask a question here. I think we're over time. So we can vote. Do you want to continue? Or
one last loud question and we'll stop.
Okay, so for me, this discussion brings out the following thing, in my opinion, fundamental point. No matter what you do, everything in wireless networks, and even more so in approved wireless networks, depends on the so-called neighborhood discovery component, its accuracy and its errors. Because everything starts from there, right? So any errors you have there, you're going to be narrowed to schedule and so on and so forth. It doesn't address your point or your particular algorithm. But I agree with Milan, okay? Unless you have some hold on that, and then use it to analyze all the algorithms, then you don't know really if the problem is with the algorithm or with your neighborhood discovery component.
But you need to know the neighborhood receive data packet.
And the other point I would make is that, I mean, what do we really mean with unicasting wireless? Before, when I put it out, broadcast, right? So the only thing that matters is what I put in the packet so that others can know. So again, this brings back to the importance of neighborhood discovery.
Right.
We
need to
have a data packet.
We
need to send
something.
Let's thank the panelists.